Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is June 26th, 2004. Today's session number is THM 2004-05. Today's speakers are Michael and Susan Thomas. The lesson for today is Middle East, especially Israel and Palestine, Gardens. Let's listen in.
I'm Susan Thomas, and my husband Michael and I served as pastors at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in the Old City of Jerusalem, starting in 1998. I returned to the States in 2002, and Michael in 2003. And we have, the work that we did there was with an English-speaking congregation, and also with so that involved a lot of internationals that were there in the land, and also with the Palestinian Lutherans, with the ELCJ, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Jordan, and the six congregations that they have, and the schools, and the work that they have done. So we are speaking out of that experience, and not as Middle East experts, not as historians. We learned a lot while we were there, and we had more time to have more experiences than probably some of you who have gone for shorter periods of time. But they are also those experiences that we carry. How many of you have been to the Holy Land area? Okay, great. And some of you, if you've been here, how many of you have been to our sessions prior to tonight? Okay, quite a number of you as well. Those of you who are coming now, you've had a little bit of a break, a couple days, can come back and kind of remember perhaps some of the things, the scenes that you've seen before, or the or see them from another perspective. We are tonight not talking specifically about the image of gardens, but are doing bread, which we didn't really do on Thursday because we had a film that we put in that was really a very recent and good film on the dividing wall in Israel-Palestine, in the West Bank. Actually, it's completely within the West Bank that this wall goes. But we moved our session that was going to be bread to this evening. So we'll have a lot of visual images for you tonight. But we want you to try to think about what we are thinking about as we bring this before you is the people and the things that were bred for us while we were there, the things that kept us going, the sustaining response that people had to one another, which worked toward justice, toward peace, toward the important things of the gospel. Sometimes those events and those encounters came with other Christians. Sometimes it came with other Jews or Muslims. And so the bread image goes across all of those as well. One of the things that we also would like to mention is that there's a very wonderful book that's recently come out, Bethlehem Besieged, by Mitri Raheb, who is the pastor of Christmas Lutheran Church in Bethlehem. It's a book of stories of hope in times of trouble, and there are some in the bookstore still for purchase. They are wonderful stories of how people, how the Palestinian people, especially from his perspective as a pastor in Bethlehem, have found ways to not simply be victims. Also, he has come up with a wonderful phrase of the need for all of the peoples there to make neighbors of enemies and not enemies of neighbors. And he has been a wonderful example of that, as has the ELCJ as a whole, the Palestinian Lutheran Church there in the Holy Land. So we'd like to then begin our time with this set of bread slides. The first one was bread that was we were on a Good Friday walk, and lo and behold, as we went through that old city and turned the corner, there was this bread that had been laid out in the form of a cross, probably completely accidentally. It was on forms like this, which would normally be carried in there on heads. Lots of bread being sold, very inexpensive, in the old city, fresh and warm, big flats of it, the pita bread, as we call it.
Mostly in shops run by Palestinians, right?
Yes, mostly, yes. Although Israelis would also carry and bake pita bread as well.
These photographs are on the east side of Jerusalem, that's to say on the Palestinian side.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this is in a bakery. It's called the French Bakery, also in East Jerusalem. And it's toward the end of the day, so there's not such a selection available. And this is in the souk, in the market in the old city, and where you have these narrow streets, and you have all these shops more or less built into the architecture and the walls of the city. And as I was walking along, I noticed this little grocery store's selection of bread for that day, along, as you can see above in the plastic containers, the olives.
In the Galilee, on the Sea of Galilee, is a place called Tabgha, which is the place where people remember the giving of the loaves and fishes by Jesus to the multitude, and this symbol of bread and abundance has been marked by Christians for centuries.
Are you going to tell us why there are only four loaves
That's
of bread
right.
there?
You can tell them now, Michael, okay?
Okay, well.
Earlier in the week, he asked, he said this.
Well, the traditional thinking on that is that there are four loaves there because the fifth loaf represents Jesus. Jesus as our bread of life,
bread of
as
life.
Our true bread.
When we were there, if I may add, Michael, the tour guide who was speaking to us said that the Eucharistic bread on the table is the fifth piece of bread. This mosaic is right underneath
the
altar table,
which is the body of Christ.
Right, which is the body of Christ.
And you saw all those loaves of pita bread in that flat box. That was the kind of bread that we normally use
right.
for our Eucharistic services. We're in Bethlehem. Bethlehem also has an old city, and we're with Mrs. Raheb, the mother of Violet and Mitri Raheb, and Barbara Rossing, who was just here. And Mitri, I don't think in this book, but in another, perhaps in this book, his mother carrying him and his sister to the Church of the Nativity, just 50 yards from where this photograph is taken, to seek shelter, to seek sanctuary during the 67 war. And as he and Najwa, his wife, comforted their children during the incursion by the Israelis and all the gunfire, the tank fire, the explosions, he wondered whether they would be likewise comforting their children in 25 years. Again, continuing in the old city.
This is a wonderful scene. I don't want to talk, even though it's you, okay?
Okay, well, let me go ahead, and I wanted to say something about Mitri.
All right. In about 1998 or 1999, this was the summer, not actually summer, it was winter. Christer Stendahl, who is in the center, is a theologian, very well known in the Lutheran Church and otherwise. And he has done a tremendous amount of work in Lutheran Jewish, Christian Jewish dialogue. And he goes each year for a conference that is held in Jerusalem by a Jewish kind of think tank there. But he is also deeply affected by and committed to what is happening to Palestinians. And we were very privileged to be part of that kind of crossing over while he visited during the time we were there, to be able to accompany him to some places that he had not been before. Well, he'd certainly been to Bethlehem many times before.
But through refugee camps.
Yeah. What was his name again, please?
Christer Stendahl.
Oh, Stendahl.
Stendahl.
Yeah. Swede. Mm-hmm. Who taught at Harvard for a while, and then was a bishop in Sweden.
Dean of Harvard Divinity School, yeah. And then Bishop of Stockholm.
Yeah.
And what, let me just mention one thing that really compels me to appreciate Mitri Rahab, and that is, living in Jerusalem, it was hard enough to plan how your day, you could have a schedule, that wasn't difficult to make a schedule, but whether it could be carried out was another question, for all sorts of reasons. Whether, you know, if you were planning to visit a parishioner who lived in the city limits of Jerusalem, you might think it's only going to take you 15 minutes to drive there, and you find out that it's going to take an hour because of what's called a rolling checkpoint, a roadblock where people's IDs are checked. And so it's very difficult. Things that have been planned for weeks or months would be canceled because of unforeseen events. And what Mitri's genius, he has many signs of creativity, but I think one great gift that he has is the ability to do the usual planning. How do you plan your week? But also to think 25 years ahead. Think about the Palestine in 25 years, the kind of Palestine he wants to see, Palestine that he would like to live in, that he would like his children to grow up in. And that takes a great gift. So it's a little bit like planting an olive tree, that if you want olives, you need to plant a tree now to have it. And he's able to do both, that thinking about the daily, what's coming up, and to envision and to dream and to make real what will be in 25 years.
Part of what that vision involves is helping the Palestinian people really develop their creativity. And they have a lot of it. But the usual kind of painting and craft work has been kind of rote in the past, or not completely
suspended.
At all. But one of the things that he has found really important is Palestinian art that can be looking in new directions. And part of the International Center in Bethlehem, which has been a ministry of that congregation and largely his vision, is to encourage artists, Palestinian artists, to view, to paint and think in new creative ways. And this, of course, is a Last Supper scene in a Palestinian setting, imagined in a Palestinian setting. And you see Jesus with the bread, breaking the bread around what would have been a big common kind of plate that everyone is eating from, probably something like makhubas. And the people would be eating, dipping with their bread or with their hands out of that common plate in this great, lovely arbor, which Michael mentioned. I hadn't realized this last, but when we saw this, was that this is on top of a kind of watchtower over the in this vineyard olive grove area.
And you could see the ruins of many, and of course Isaiah wrote about watchtowers and over the vineyards.
Is there any significance with the one figure that isn't wearing a head?
Kafia?
Go back to it.
The one who's not. I don't know. Probably, but I don't know who that would be.
Now, it looks like there might. This is a picture I took here from a postcard. So the reproduction is not very good. It looks like there's a man also on the left that doesn't have any kind of head covering, but I'm not sure.
But it may just be reflecting, you know, not everybody wears a head covering in Palestinian society, so maybe it's just that.
Yeah.
Perhaps it represents John, as he looks so young.
Could be.
Yeah.
Could be.
And then this is the wedding. I'm just going to mention this very briefly. This is the wedding of Violet Rahab 2 years ago. She was, until 2 years ago, the director of the ELCJ schools, the Palestinian Lutheran schools. The schools are a very, very important part of the ministry of the Palestinian Lutheran Church. And she had the great good fortune to fall in love with another Palestinian, a classical Arabic singer living in Vienna. And he was from the Galilee, and he and his family had left in 1948 and lived in a refugee camp in Lebanon. And they had this dream that he would be able to live in Bethlehem, her hometown. And in sort of the opposite of what you expect in Palestinian society, he was going to become Lutheran. Normally, the woman takes on the church affiliation of the husband, but he was going to become Lutheran. He's a Greek Orthodox. And
he would be revitalizing the musical.
Yeah, he's a very sought singer in Europe.
Yeah.
And also in other parts of the Middle East. And the Israelis said, no, you can't come back, even though you're Palestinian. You left in 1948.
So even to live in Palestinian area.
Yeah.
Not in Israel, but in Palestine.
Yeah, he was not allowed back. And so the wedding took place at the Lutheran church. There was a Palestinian Lutheran church.
He couldn't come back even for the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
He couldn't have the wedding
there either. In Amman, Jordan. And it was a wonderful festive event, and it was like a family reunion because people that had fled that area in 1948 to Lebanon or to Jordan or elsewhere, and people, Palestinians who still lived in Haifa, that is in today's Israel, and in Bethlehem, they all came together. And so it was this large family reunion because many of these people had not seen each other since 1948.
Some of you may have heard her speaking at a global mission event 2 years, three years ago.
Longer than two, I think maybe three or four, ELCA.
Very dynamic.
And so while this picture represents for me, it was a great joy to be able to go to the wedding. I won't even tell you how long it took her to go from Bethlehem to Amman, how difficult that trip was. If you could just drive it without international boundaries and checkpoints, it's an hour and a half.
Yeah.
But it took overnight. But the sadness contained in this photograph is that this is one more creative Palestinian couple that have had to leave Palestine, have had to leave the Holy Land, because they are not allowed to live in the land of their birth. And so now they live in Europe, and Viola is doing all sorts of wonderful creative things. In addition, her creativity and has been expressed in giving birth to a wonderful boy that Mitri just baptized 3 weeks ago. But they're not in their homeland.
Say, Michael.
Yeah.
I've heard it described that that's actually part of one of the many goals of the occupation is to drive out people like him.
Oh, yeah.
So that you have only so that you have more easily controlled people.
No, it's very easy.
Is that accurate from your perspective?
From Palestine and Israel.
Well, I mean, you also then have a more. I'm not sure that means you have these people may be pliable in other ways that are not so good for Israel either. You know, it's best to have an educated intelligent leadership still in place rather than people who can't think well and in future, if you're going to try to make make anything, it's not good for Israel to have an uneducated, easily influenced, angry population in the middle of it. That's not good for Israel either. So I don't know whether that would be seen as that they're really trying to get rid of the leaders or not.
That's I think we need to move on. Let me just say what my slant is on these things. What I've imagined in having these pictures shown throughout the past week has been to be a kind of simulation of what it would be if we were all to go on a trip, say, organized by Chuck Lutz, who takes groups of North Americans to the Holy Land, to Palestine and Israel, what it would be like. And you're tired out now. You've just landed at, say, in Minneapolis or Seattle. You're tired out. You have lots of pictures that you've taken using a camera, but you have all these images in your mind and memory. And these are the images that I hope are hope-filled images of reasons to be hopeful that someday people will find a way, they will struggle through to some kind of just peace. So this is two dear friends at the Redeemer Church, Maurice and Daniil, and we'll see Maurice in a number of other pictures, but he was educated at the University of Kiev as a chemical engineer. He speaks fluent Russian, Arabic, some Hebrew, and some English and some German, and he works as a doorman. He's the person that welcomes you when you go into the large sanctuary and lets you go up to the tower.
At Redeemer.
In the old city. And that was the church Susan and I served. This is another dear family. Zugby's just representing the complexities of Palestinian life. Elaine came to Bethlehem many years ago, met and fell in love. She's an American, met and fell in love with Zugby, the man on the right. That's one of their children, Tarek, and she knows how difficult it is to stay. So she took her children and lived in the United States the past year, but it was too hard. And so now they're back in Bethlehem, and she's worried for her family. And
one of the hopeful signs is that when people, when the churches can help, when our churches can help to see that people will stay by giving scholarships or helping scholarships be given to students like this young woman who will be attending college this coming year in the area. So the idea is that to educate people to stay, not to bring them out of the country to study elsewhere where they may not return, but to try to help the Christians there.
And so this is a $2,000 a year commitment. Your congregations can do this. It's $2,000 a year for 4 years, and you can do this through the Division for Global Mission of the ELCA. Imagine, how would you like to be able to send your son or daughter to college for $2,000 a year? And speaking of the Division for Global Mission, the man on your right is Sayyid Al-Labouni, who was born in Nazareth, educated at Concordia Moorhead, and is a coordinator for Europe and the Middle East of the Division for Global Mission. And he is talking to Lydia Mansour, who is the director of the Peace Center for the Blind. And that's one of the ministries that our congregation in Jerusalem and the ELCA, so those of you who are ELCA members, have contributed to, is a school to educate, to help blind women, mostly Muslim, learn skills such as knitting, learn to be able to read, even to learn some computer skills, and to try to live a semi-independent life. It's very difficult if you're a blind woman in the West Bank to be able to live independently.
She told our group last December, visiting from the States, that about 90% of their support from outside, from international support financially, comes from U.S. Lutherans.
Is that so?
And it comes through both the ELCA World Hunger Direct Grants and through Lutheran World Relief. And they're very grateful for that.
And this is Sayyid again, and we're going to draw a little bit closer to the Intifada, that the violence that began at the end of September 2000, but we're in an abandoned cemetery in Tiberias where Sayyid has family
on
members.
On the
Sea of Galilee. We are there for a retreat, a prayer for times of trouble. And so we've taken some of our confirmation class, and he's showing these boys where his family, some of his family, are buried. And you can see the cemetery has fallen on hard times because there are no more Palestinians there. In Tiberias, they're only Jews. And this is at the same retreat, and
And we're eating. You'll see some scenes of people eating as we go through with this bread theme. But this is some of the people from our congregation have gone on this retreat. This is a retreat that actually we held right, it was the same weekend that the Intifada broke out, September 29th of 2000. And it was a very interesting thing going out of the city at the very time that chaos was breaking out. Being up in the Galilee area and not, you know, people having their cell phones, and some of the people with us were reporters or were involved with NGOs who had people in other places and were getting calls about what was going on. And it was a very uncertain time. And while we were there, one of the beautiful little, this is in a Scottish hospice areas, has this courage, "It is I, be not afraid," pillar in the chapel.
It's the Sea of Galilee
and the story of Jesus coming across to his disciples and encouraging them. And that was a
because no one knew what was happening. Mm-hmm. We didn't know, if we came up the Jordan River Valley, we didn't know how we would be able to get back. All sorts of rumors about what was going on, both in the state of Israel and in the West Bank, were going on.
This same class, the class that was confirmed in the spring of 2001, is here, and they have none of those children are any longer in Jerusalem in the area. Three of them are Palestinians, and they have their families have moved to the United States. The others are internationals, and you would have expected them to probably not be there any longer. But what's sad is the Palestinians have left.
Just our congregation, this was taken after Susan returned to the United States in September 2000. I just sent her a picture to show her what the congregation was like on a particular Sunday.
One of the things that was so moving for us, I don't want to say too much, but this is so important to me, in terms of bread, that I wish that every pastor could have the chance to preach to a congregation who is just so hungry for words of hope each time that they gather together. This was the kind of thing that was our privilege to be part of, to be able to be seeing people just ready to hear these words of hope.
We were pastors in Vienna, Austria, beautiful, beautiful part of the world to work in, to live in. And people in our congregation, newcomers, new members would say, you know, I was very active in my church in England or Australia or in the United States, but here I really want to be able to see Europe. This is my opportunity. I'm going to be here for 3 years, and so I'm not sure what Sundays I'm going to be here. We of course want wonderful sermons and wonderful Christian education, but I can't really commit myself. And so, you know, it was sort of church as a kind of optional Sunday activity if you were in Vienna on a particular Sunday. Here, everybody that was part of the community was there every Sunday. Really, that was the case.
Ooh. The kids, you know, it was, again, you know, the bread of just being able to be out and have fun and groups together, but always this kind of looming experience of the occupation. Up above here is Gilo. We're in Israel. This is a zoo. It's a wonderful place within Israel, within Jerusalem. But Gilo is one of the settlements that is on the border, on the ring of the outskirts of Jerusalem. This is wonderful as well. In our congregation, part of the bread that helped us all was the Christian Peacemaker team, and they had been in Hebron, are in Hebron, in the West Bank, and have kept a nonviolent Christian presence there in the hopes of being in place to keep vengeance and violence from flaring up too much. So they will put themselves between when it seems like they could actually dampen something down. in a nonviolent way. Anyway, they live in a lot of tension, of course, and are wonderful, committed Christian people. And they also knew that they needed fun. And so Pierre over here, this wonderful Canadian, decided we need fun. We're gonna have Shrove Tuesday pancake meal, and we're gonna have it at your house. And so, so they came, and he made pancakes all day, getting prepared for this.
It really lifted up sort of Holden's holy hilarity, and that was that you need to have a sense of joy too in the midst of and particularly for those living in Hebron, very, very difficult situation.
Hebron, I think, is a city of about 120,000 Palestinians and 500 Jewish settlers.
That section of the city, Hebron itself is larger. That section that was under Israeli control was 120 or 130,000 people.
And then 500 Israeli settlers.
Settlers in the center of it.
Yeah.
Guarded by...
Maybe 1,200.
Protected by the Israeli military.
Yeah,
right.
And so this is the Christian Peacemaker team. They're just doing a wonderful skit. And you can see they're all ages there. And so many times we have a lot of grandmothers doing very risky things. You know, standing in front of soldiers with guns. And standing like this and saying, "Don't shoot. If you shoot, you have to shoot through me." And this is one of the saints.
She's not a grandmother, she's a Roman Catholic sister.
But. Yeah, and a Catholic worker who's part of Christian Peacemakers has been in Baghdad for the last year until April.
And the Christian Peacemaker team members come from around the world, right?
They do, although mostly North America. Occasionally had people from Europe. Specifically. This is Sandra Oline, and next to her is Douglas Dix. You can't really see him. She was a representative of the United Methodist Church there, and Doug was part of the Presbyterian Church USA. They are leading us on a way, Stations of the Cross, but at places that signify death and oppression and suffering and
Today.
Yeah. So this is a place where homes are going to be, a Palestinian home is going to be demolished at this place. And so she's on sabbatical in a sense right now. She goes back to Bethlehem in July. She serves as the assistant pastor at the Christmas Lutheran Church.
Which is astonishing also as a woman.
And Heather Ritt, who works for World Vision, who does all sorts of wonderful work. It's all these people that both Palestinians and Israelis and internationals that try to find ways to create hope where there is no hope. This is the Sabil Center for Palestinian Liberation Theology, a group of people working there. Margaret and Betty Bailey, the elderly couple in the center, have done wonderful work in communicating the story of the Palestinians, and they also are the authors of a book that's in the bookstore, Christians of the Middle East.
And Nora...
I'm sorry. Should I go back?
Yes.
Yeah. Oops.
Never mind. Not that far.
Nora is a Palestinian, actually out of the Armenian Orthodox Church, and she is one of the people that I worked with for the World Day of Prayer, which was a great, wonderful cross-section of Palestinian women. It was one of the high points of my time there.
From all the Christian traditions?
From all the Christian traditions.
I have a question, and I am pretty naive politically about all the things that are happening over there. I know the tip of the iceberg, so I'll just go ahead and show my ignorance.
That's fine.
You said there's an Israeli settlement, you're talking about the Jewish people coming back in there, and they're the ones that are bulldozing down the Palestinian homes that have been there?
They themselves, the settlers, are not doing the bulldozing. The bulldozers come from the Israeli government.
Israeli government is reclaiming, and they're doing it. But how do they get the Palestinian families out if they don't move out of the house at all?
I'd be glad to talk about it. It's really a long story, but it goes back to, of course, Abraham's purchase of cave in Hebron. And we can talk about it, but essentially then in the 1920s, there was a Jewish community in Hebron. Many were massacred in 1929. 1929, and many Jews that lived there at the time were also saved by Palestinians. From 1929 to, what, 19, do you know the date, Chuck?
1948?
No, later. 1970s. There were no Jews. Then some Jews
73?
After the 67 war. Yeah, after
the Yom Kippur war.
They, some Jews came to stay in a hotel in the center of Hebron. And they stayed and stayed and stayed and essentially established and said, we're not leaving. It forced the Israeli government then to protect them. And then Jewish students came. And so now today there's a community, there are several communities in this intense environment that live there. Somewhere between 400 and 500 Jews live in the center of Hebron. And they are saying, this is our land and we're not leaving.
This one in Hebron is a particularly fanatical group of settlers.
And religiously identified.
Yeah. Yeah,
almost all from the New York area.
But many of the other settlements people are there because it's economically easier to start their life in Israel.
It would be interesting if Native Americans made claim to the land that we all live on. This is our home.
Yeah.
It's very much the same thing.
It's a good parallel.
Very good parallel.
This is a Finnish couple that also are bred for the people of Palestine, Marty and Birko Tukanen, who have been there many years, and who Birko, the woman on the right, recently was an angel to the New England Synod delegation that was visiting at the end of May. The New England Synod delegation of 13 members had somehow gotten separated. They were going through a checkpoint. And because it was the same day that many Palestinians were killed in Gaza, there was an outbreak of violence at the checkpoint. So that typically happens by Palestinians, boys throwing rocks, the soldiers shooting back, tear gas, rubber bullets, etc. It gets very dicey at those points. And so the New England delegation was quite concerned. Birko speaks Arabic. She saw what was developing, and she wasn't going to. She knows that she turns around and goes back. She was in Ramallah, which is a city just north of Jerusalem. The checkpoint is between Jerusalem and Ramallah. She was going to go back to Ramallah to spend the night. But some Palestinians said, there's an American group up ahead. You have to go help them. And so she ducked and ran underneath rocks and found this American group and was able to get them through the checkpoint and out.
There's lots of opportunities for celebration too, and this is a wonderful Palm Sunday procession from Bethany to into the gates of the city of Jerusalem.
It's a parade. It's not parade,
yeah.
A procession. It's a parade.
It's a parade.
And we give. I mean, you have to find holy hilarity. We give awards to sort of the best group. I mean, it's wonderful. Often it's the groups from women from the Philippines. They are always strong contenders. I think this group might have been top 10 that year.
And they're musical groups.
Oh,
yeah. And this is another
float.
This is a float. This is during, I took this picture during Sukkot 3 weeks ago to celebrate the Torah. Where if you're Jewish, you stay up all night and read the Torah. Hundreds and hundreds of places in Israel. And you read the Torah all night long. And then if you live in Jerusalem, I went to a Hasidic group from Hungary. They don't recognize the state of Israel. They're anti-Zionist Hasidic Jews. It's a long story. And you go down at 5:30 in the morning to the Western Wall, and you watch the sun rise over the Mount of Olives. A Jewish family in the old city.
And so I'm coming up here to a tent on the boundary between Bethlehem and between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and an Israeli human rights activist has taken on a fast at this border for peace, and specifically for Israel to get out of Bethlehem at that point.
Is she still there?
No.
No, she got very, very weak, and people urged her not to continue the fast.
She wasn't getting the kind of entrance into Bethlehem was eclipsing everything else that was happening. She wasn't getting any attention really, and she really wanted people to be aware of this effort.
A question back there.
Are there North American Jewish peacekeeping teams or groups that
there are North American Jews that come to work for peace and justice in a variety of ways, often with something called the International Solidarity Movement, or with the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions. We'll show you some pictures in a few minutes of Jews working with Palestinians. And I'm going to go at people that are read. One of our son's teachers, he was the man. He's a Oxford-educated Briton who teaches at our son's school in Jerusalem, and he was the one that he's a crossover person. He took me to the Hasidic synagogue for a full night of singing and services. And friends. These are two American Jewish friends in the art world, and then the Bennetts, who are good friends, he's the correspondent for the New York Times, chief correspondent, and their son Isaac on the little bench. But just the need for finding people you could talk with and be with and find a way to sort of keep on this journey. They are bred for the journey. And last year when Susan was, the last year I was in Jerusalem when she was in the United States, the Snyders had me over almost for every Sabbath. And a couple of other men whose wives had also departed for England or the United States. So we called ourselves the fractured, band of brothers. Yeah, and that's... And birthday parties are, of course, important. It's at our house and home in Jerusalem. And Christmas. And baseball. Here's an international and Jewish group we're at. Baseball was sort of my great joy, to take my mind off of what was going on and to help coach. And so we played essentially Jewish teams, mostly parents from the New York, children, parents from the New York area or Chicago.
Are a lot of the settlers, Jewish settlers who are in Palestine, in settlements, mm-hmm. are they from Israel or from international countries? I mean,
they're from both.
Is there a predominance of one or the other?
There are Russians who have made Aliyah, who have immigrated to Israel.
There are quite a few Americans among them.
There are about 400. There are about 400,000 Israelis who now live in the occupied West Bank, and that's of course since 1967, and many since the Oslo Peace Agreement.
Real quickly, sometimes bread was the getting being able to leave for a short time. The first group was a youth group that went to a session, went away for a while to Europe, and this is a group of ELCA. And the ELCA supported missionaries in the Middle East that have gathered on the island of Cyprus.
So the woman in the orange top is Lebanese. She runs the Christian Center for Rehabilitation. The Center for Rehabilitation. And that's an in Beirut. That's an ELCA ministry. Saeed Elabouni, is her sort of connection to the ELCA, said he was picked up at the airport one time. And the person picking him up he couldn't believe that this person could drive a car. He had, an arm and a leg missing, but the car had been outfitted so he could negotiate Middle East driving with aplomb. And so these are our colleagues, and we also needed to get away. This is on the island of Cyprus. And a group photo also on the island of Cyprus, of the families. It's also important that not just the main workers, but also the families are there to talk and be together.
We are moving now to three stories, and I hope we can get to all of them. But the first one is in August of 2001, the Lutheran Boys Home Orphanage and Church Grounds of the Church of the Reformation in Beit Jala, which is a neighboring town to Bethlehem, was occupied by Israeli soldiers during an incursion into Bethlehem. This is Bishop Muneeb Younan of the ELCJ, not at that very moment getting the call, but he was often on the phone getting various calls. This is a picture of him receiving messages. He gathered a group of international as much support as he could get, basically, to go on a kind of mercy mission to this boys' home, where the boys had been kept. Well, they were really traumatized. They'd been put in a room. The soldiers had told them they could only stay there, and there was no food because the whole place was under curfew.
There was no water. The tank on the right weighs 60 tons, which is hard to imagine. And so it broke the water lines going into the church. And so they're in a dark room, and they're told they cannot come out. There's shooting around going on. There are people up there, soldiers, Israeli soldiers, in this tower, in another tower on the roof. And they are, in turn, drawing fire. So it becomes a very dangerous situation for if any of the children were to leave the room that they were ordered to stay in. And the pastor of the church, who lives in the below, wasn't allowed to come up to the church. And he is friends.
They are his children.
So Muneeb is trying to get, first of all, support in the immediate local area with Israelis, and with international consulates. The Israelis insist there are no soldiers there. They say it's a fabrication, there are no soldiers there. And then Muneeb, I think we called the ELCA at about 2 in the morning, Chicago time, and from there, you know, the word started spreading, and the same thing all around the world. The Secretary General of Lutheran World Federation was in South Africa. And so all these calls went out from that desk that you saw Muneeb sitting at, and that had a tremendous effect, both the local coming together and the international pressure.
And it says something about the importance of the international church connections. The Washington office of the ELCA then immediately intervened with the State Department.
One of the statements that came out then from the State Department specifically mentioned the boys' home that was being occupied.
Right.
Who made the tank?
Yes. Who manufactured the tank? Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of the Israeli armament is U.S. made.
I'd like to know the rest. I mean, how long before the boys were able to?
Well, we'll tell you.
Okay.
this is called the building that was being constructed as part of this church compound was called Abraham's House, and was intended to be an encounter place for Christians, Jews, and Muslims, particularly youth, both from the land and internationally.
And that's really the sign that was great earlier that day.
And when we came that day, we were having a different kind of an encounter between Muslims, Jews, and Christians than was envisioned originally. This is Bishop Muneeb and the rest of our group bringing in supplies. And the House Father telling the Bishop really what had gone on.
And of course, the children are the focus of attention. And in this congregation, the Church of Hope and the Church of the Reformation in Beit Jala, which is a little village adjacent to Bethlehem,
yeah.
The children are like, they're, they really are the children of the congregation, and they are dearly loved by the congregation, and the pastor is really a kind of father.
So they had alerted the press as well, and so they had come with us in.
How many boys?
About 60. No, 80. No, 80.
No, 60.
60. And through this door, the Israeli soldiers are occupying the church and are up on the roof. And still, even at this point, the Israeli military is telling Manin, there are no soldiers there. And Pastor Jadala, the man facing on the right, facing out, is pointing to the door. There, you could see him. We could go over there, and we would try to engage him in conversation. And they wouldn't, very interesting to talk about.
Were these soldiers acting independently then, or was the Israeli...
Well, this was the interesting question, wasn't it? Yeah.
Doesn't that happen some, that there are, in quotes, renegades or whatever, who do act independently?
No,
They weren't. Okay. No. But when Bishop Manib talked to the commanding officer and told them that they were there, and the commanding officer said, no, they aren't, he said, well, they are, and if you don't know where your troops are, you really ought to know where they are. And he then, this was the higher level. The people who had brought him in, I mean, the commanding officers that brought them in certainly knew they were there. They were taken, at the end of that day, how it ended was that we were given the promise that the soldiers would be out by 8 o'clock that night. And so we left, and they were out by 8 o'clock that night.
And this, what was so hopeful about this day was that we could see very clearly when there was a specific instance of injustice and illegal action, namely soldiers occupying a church against various laws, that when international pressure was brought to bear, along with local nonviolent creative resistance, we could be successful. And that was the message of hope that came out of that day. And this is a picture taken 3 weeks ago at that same place, Abraham's Herberge, House of Abraham. And the New England delegation is staying there, and it's a wonderful place. So I hope you visit there.
Was that international press?
Both local.
It was mostly local, mostly Palestinian.
Oh, there were international too. Mm-hmm.
This is a second event. This is in the spring of 2002, going to bring some aid to Bethlehem during the time that it was being besieged.
And so it was under curfew, and we had a number of trucks and a number of internationals. We'll have to go through this story quickly, but This is a wonderful instance where a Palestinian in our congregation, a grandmother of one of the boys confirmed at the confirmation, gave us something like $25 to add to the food that we were bringing. So we went to our greengrocer and we said, we are going to Bethlehem and we're bringing food to people that haven't been able to get food. What would you recommend? So we got our $25 of mostly vegetables, as you can see. And then he just kept filling bag after bag after bag. This was a Muslim. And he knew what it was to be hungry. All he could think about were the children. And so we had a Volkswagen van full of food from this grocer.
Along with the other supplies that were coming, the more.
And our friend Maurice, this is in Beit Jala, again, talking to the German pastor. And then as we came in with all these trucks, it was all orchestrated because it was done officially through the Israeli administration and military control. The Syrian Orthodox bishop, archbishop, came in with us, sort of undercover, so that he could see his Syrian Orthodox community because it was impossible for him to get in. And so he was able to come in with an international group that often provides coverage of one sort or another for local Palestinians to be able to come in. And people were just delighted to be able to see him, because he had not been there during the time that Bethlehem was under siege. And then, as we were able to distribute food, people from sort of outlying, even smaller villages, would come in taxis. Curfew had been lifted for 2 hours. So when we came in, there were no cars.
Explain what a curfew is.
Curfew is
it's not being in at midnight.
Yeah, it's house imprisonment. Is a succinct way of expressing it. And so a small village from outside of Bethlehem came, and the boxes of food were put on.
And this is the third story. This is at the end of the siege of Bethlehem. And we are coming to the Christmas church for a wonderful celebrative service after Israel has withdrawn from Bethlehem, and the people who are holed up in the Church of the Nativity have been sent off to other countries, and the whole thing has finally come to an end, not a resolution. But the wonderful thing about this was that the service that was being held at Christmas Lutheran was attended also by some Jewish Israeli human rights activists. Two of them are seated here. They had come in, and it was a courageous action on their part, as well as a courageous action on the part of Maitri Rahab and Bishop Muneeb to invite them to come, because it wasn't an easy time to be associated with one another.
So what we had done, our worship is at 9 in the morning. Bethlehem's worship is at 10:30. So we had an abbreviated worship service, and we came as many as we could. Some came in armored cars, because that was how various NGOs and diplomats were traveling around. Others, like us, just came in our cars because we felt safe. And so, for instance, you have Lois and Craig Kipples. Craig was, until recently, the representative of Lutheran World Federation to Jerusalem. And then you have that angel that I mentioned, Birko Tukani. And Jeremy Milgram, the Jewish man between Lois and Craig, I didn't realize till I talked to him last month that he had actually been very afraid about coming, because I always saw him as a very fearless individual. And I didn't realize that he actually had been afraid. So it was a second Easter for us coming from Jerusalem, but it was their first Easter in a sense. They had, of course, Easter services, but not very many people could come. And so this is the first time the Israelis have left the city that people can come and celebrate the presence of Christ with one another. And of course, in the
40 days after Easter, isn't it? About,
yeah. Yeah. About 40 days, yeah.
Well, 40 was always a very significant biblical number.
Yep.
There's Sandra Olwine. I mentioned that she was there. And a wonderful picture of Violet Rahab still in Bethlehem and Jeremy Milgram greeting one another as friends. And this is what Mitri said, how much better it is to make a friend of your neighbor than an enemy of your neighbor.
He's an Israeli Jew.
Yeah. And the Church of the Nativity, where after worship, everybody went down. It's about 200 yards from the Christmas Lutheran Church, went down because there had been a siege also within that church. And so everyone wanted to see what was the church, the state of the church in the inside.
It was a kind of reclaiming of the church after the site of violence.
And Maurice again with his daughter.
Who kept you with your web page going? Because then you were updating that every few hours, it seemed like.
Well, it wasn't us.
Yeah, it was internationals and people in Bethlehem.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't know when their servers would be down.
Yeah.
You mean the Bethlehem side?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. They were.
And delegations, the groups of ordinary and extraordinary ordinary individuals that Chuck Lutz and others brings, and ELCA delegations are very important. To come as a sign that we remember you. We remember your struggle, along with the struggle of Israelis for peace and justice. You are not forgotten. And in return, there's this powerful sense of hope from people Palestinians and Israelis that are working for peace and justice.
That's Bishop Hansen.
Yes,
yes, Bishop Hansen. Yeah.
This was the New England delegation that I mentioned that was in Jerusalem at the end of May.
That's
a congregation.
And another way that the ELCA supports and helps and works in accompaniment with the Palestinian Lutheran Church is by offering the services of gifted individuals such as Mary Jensen, who many of you have received reports from her, letters from Jerusalem and updates on the Palestinian Lutheran Church. She has just completed her service. This is at the end of May, and we're having a reception in her honor. And the ecumenical accompaniment in Palestine and Israel. These are groups international, some from the United States, some Lutherans that come and accompany the Palestinians, sometimes in such things as simply helping them get to their olive fields, helping them, bringing in medicine to outlying villages, from Augusta, Victoria, the Lutheran World Federation Hospital, while observing at checkpoints how Palestinians are able or are not able to cross checkpoints. And so this was a kind of, this was a day which they received their vest, and each one, this is at our church, each one received an olive sprig.
I don't know if any of you are familiar with the famous Orthodox icon of the Trinity, where the three angels that visited Abraham and Sarah are seated around a table, and it has become, for Christians, a sign of the Trinity. This is actually an icon in a similar style, done about the story of the meal at Emmaus. And so you see Jesus in the center with the two disciples whom he accompanied on the way. And this is just a reminder to us that the accompaniment of the people in those lands is so important. And the ELCA, in fact, I guess about 8 years ago, maybe even less, chose as its mission paradigm that story of Luke 24, of the accompaniment, the walking together on the road as its sign.
This is our last slide. I'm back in New Hampshire now, but wherever you go, there's a Jerusalem somewhere. And to keep that tie to Jerusalem. I mean, I know for Susan and me that every single day we remember that tie to Jerusalem, that land of the resurrection. And we saw pictures of Bethlehem, land of the incarnation. That it is crucial. It's a wellspring for our ministry, and so I encourage all of you to remember and to pray for the peace of Jerusalem and to visit Jerusalem if you can, even if for a short time, or to think about these wilder, riskier, and also wonderful opportunities for service with various accompanying groups.
We had, Chuck had asked for a couple of minutes to just speak about the Churches for Middle East Peace as well and some of the accompaniment.
Yeah, let me add very quickly two things. One is that there is an organization of the mainline Protestant and Roman Catholic and at least one Orthodox agencies in the United States, church agencies based in Washington, including that of the ELCA, called Churches for Middle East Peace. And the focus is to do lobbying with members of Congress, particularly, sometimes with the administration, on the Holy Land conflict, and to do education in local churches. And I coordinate that work in Minnesota. We do that kind of thing with all of the churches in Minnesota that are interested in participating. And if you'd like to get plugged into that wherever you live, Churches for Middle East Peace has a newsletter, both by email and in print form, that they'll put you on the list for. There are some copies of recent newsletters up here. Most recent one, Actions, and it's always policy analysis, U.S. policy, foreign policy analysis in relation to Israel-Palestine. The latest one is titled Actions and Inactions by Sharon and Bush, put two-state solution at risk. So please pick up one of those if you're interested. The ELCA has a network organized, coordinated by Ann Hafton, whom some of us know, by email for networking ELCA people on the Middle East issue in the name of the ELCA. And there's a copy of the sheet here about that that includes also some websites that you can plug into. And then there's a sheet that talks about how we can be supportive financially of the Lutheran ministries in the Holy Land, some of which you mentioned, particularly aid to their schools, which are in serious trouble financially because under the occupation, and particularly the last 4 years, there's a high unemployment among Palestinians, and many people can't even pay the minimal tuition, and so they need support from outside to keep going. Those schools, by the way, intentionally enroll roughly 50% Muslims and 50% Christians. That's their goal, to do that. Have Muslim and Christian young people learning together. The other thing I want to mention is, as has already been alluded to, I do an annual trip to the Holy Land for people who are interested in going and at least in that short span of about 12 days, having some kind of accompaniment and solidarity with the Palestinian Christians, but also Palestinians in general, and with Israeli peace and human rights groups. We always meet with them and try to give them support, and we also do some traditional biblical site visits, but mostly it's time spent with peace and human rights groups and with the local Christians. The local Christians are always asking for that, and they're frankly quite offended that large numbers of Christian Zionists go, mainly from the United States, and never meet with the local Christians. They meet with the more right-wing Israeli political groups, but they don't meet with local Christians, which is an offense. And partly to provide some counter to that, I think it's important that we organize groups of visitors from other parts of the world to go as pilgrims, and to at least spend some time with the local Christians. So if any of you are interested or have a friend who may be interested in a trip, we've got one scheduled for October, the latter part of October this year, and we still have room to add some more people, and you can see me afterward if you're interested in getting more information.
Thank you, Chuck.
Yep.
That brings us to an end then. I know that people probably have questions or comments. Susan and I are going to be in the village this week as guests, and we would be delighted simply to talk with people, to have talk over coffee or over lunch or over a meal, talk about our experiences, and also hear from you about your impressions or experiences. So we will be here during this week, and then I understand on Thursday we will be showing the film The Dividing Wall, which is about the wall of separation, and that will be it's a 23-minute film. It's a very powerful, good film where you hear mostly Palestinian voices. And then the discussion will flow out of that as well. So thank you very much for coming. I think